Welcome to Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today is an author, but it's probably easier to describe him by what he's not. He's no longer an editor. He's not a sports writer, but he's written what's been described as one of the best books about sport. He's not a musician, but he's written a brilliant book about music. He's also not one of at least 10 people in the public eye who go by the same name. Andy Miller, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Thanks very much.
Let's start with who you're not.
Who I'm not,
yeah. Because there are many, many Andy Millers.
Yes, I'm at great pains to always point out to any, just to double check with anyone who comes to an event that I do, that they haven't accidentally come to see the novelist Andrew Miller, because he and I do not operate in the same area at all. Andrew is a brilliant writer, very serious writer. I am not a very serious writer, although I write about serious things. I don't know if I'm a brilliant writer or not. I try to be a brilliant writer, but he writes novels. I don't write novels. It's also worth saying one of the things that I found quite funny when I thought it would be great to talk about what it's like to have the same name as another more famous writer. I'm Andy Miller, he's Andrew Miller. But then I discovered there were other writers called, there's a poet called Andrew Miller. There's a thriller writer called Andrew Miller who goes under the name A.D. Miller. There's the head of the Brooklyn Dance Company is called Andrea Miller. There's a baseball player called Andrew Miller. There's literally dozens of relatively well-known Andy Millers.
Have you ever thought about changing your name?
No, because it's my name.
Well, it's not. But
it's my name. It's a sort of passive aggressive. This is the thing, right? This is the reason why I'm called on Twitter. I'm called Mill I Am on Twitter, not Will I Am. I'm called Mill I Am because I thought it was a funny joke for about 2 minutes 5 years ago. But partly to say I am as entitled to the name Andy Miller as anybody else called Andy Miller.
So. Absolutely. Tell us about the young Andy Miller then.
He was a bookish child. Yes, he didn't really like to go outdoors much. He very much liked to stay indoors and read books. I didn't just like reading books, and I'm very keen to always, when I talk about this, you know, I love books, but I do love other things as well. I love music, and I love film, and I love all sorts of culture. But fundamentally, it's the great indoors, which is my passion, yes.
Mm-hmm. Which led you into working with books. What were your first few jobs?
My first job was, so I was writing. I was trying to get a comedy career off the ground. And like many budding comedians, what I did was I got a job in a bookshop where I intended to stay for 3 months and I ended up staying for 7 years. So I worked at a branch of Waterstones in Brighton, and subsequently then I worked at other bookshops in London, and I sort of had a love-hate relationship with that job. I loved the proximity to books, and I wasn't so keen on the proximity to the public and the people who bought the books. And I think if you're a brilliant bookseller, you have to love both. Had I had the opportunity to go into a career in libraries, at one level that would have been absolutely perfect for me. But even libraries now are under threat, so I still wouldn't perhaps have found my niche. I don't know. I was a bookseller for many years, and then I was asked to do a project. Waterstones, the book chain, used to produce a desk diary every year. I don't know if you remember it or not, but it was a nice thing. It was like and what they would do is they would get a bookseller on secondment from a branch of Waterstones, and you would go and work in head office for a few months, and you would create, design, edit a book. So it's the best job in Waterstones, basically. It was such a good gig. And I was very lucky at the second attempt I got a chance to do that. And so the first publishing project that I was ever involved with was, it involved a bit of everything. It involved understanding what a cover looks like, research. It involved choosing extracts that worked in context, but it also involved applying for permissions to use those extracts. And as a result of that, I sort of saw the light and decided that that's what I needed to focus on after that. So making books rather than selling books, you know.
You moved into editing.
Yes. So I went to work at an independent publisher called Fourth Estate in the UK. When I joined them, they were the publisher of a book called Longitude by Darv Sobel. The week I joined them, they had the top 5 slots in the Sunday Times bestseller list, which is unprecedented anyway, but for a small independent publisher, it was an incredible thing. So I was a commissioning editor. I would ask writers to work on books, and I would speak to agents and get agents to send me things they wanted me to publish. And I didn't sleep for a year, the first year I did that. The extent to which I didn't know what I was doing, that there's no manual. You just hope for the best. So I totally learnt on the job. But I work with such interesting people, you know. I work with some musicians and some comedians and some political writers, and I sort of learnt what works and what doesn't work on the page. Yeah. I mean, you're always learning what works and what doesn't work as a page, if you're an editor or a writer or whatever. But as a way of understanding how you make an idea, how you get an idea out of your head onto the page, but then off the page and into the mind of the reader, that is the discipline and the skill, you know.
And when did you start doing that for yourself, putting things on the page yourself, writing?
Well, I've always written. I've been doing some journalism and I've done bits and pieces, done stuff on the radio. In about, I think, 1999, I was in Great Yarmouth, which is a seaside town in Norfolk, and I was playing a round of crazy golf, which is what we in the UK call miniature golf. Everyone else in the world calls it miniature golf. Only we call it crazy golf, right? So I was playing a round of crazy golf, like you do, and I was talking to a friend of mine who is a sports nut. I hate sport. And he and I were playing this, and he was saying, come on, you like this. If you like this, you'll like other sports. And I was saying, this isn't a sport. And he was going, but what if it were a sport? And I had that one of those moments of thinking, my goodness, there's a book in that. I know it doesn't sound very promising, does it? But I actually thought, wow, it would be so interesting to write about what it means to be a man when you don't like sport. But instead of using a sport that all the other men take seriously, like football or cricket or rugby or any of the horrible things I had to play when I was at school, you could choose a sport that was taken more seriously in the rest of the world than it was taken in the UK, and then apply a series of stress tests to it to see what would happen. And so that's what I did. I went on tour on the professional miniature golf circuit. I represented the UK at the European Miniature Golf Championships in Riga, Latvia. I came last by a huge margin, and the Baltic Times sent a man to cover the event, and he interviewed me, and when the paper appeared the next day, it described me as the Eddie the Eagle of miniature golf. So I was thinking, okay, well, this will be fun to write about.
Or the Don Quixote, in fact. It's called Tilting at Windmills.
It is called Tilting at Windmills, yes. Windmill being the obstacle that you most commonly find on a miniature or crazy golf course.
How did that then lead on to your next book?
Okay, so I felt I had clocked up some awful cosmic debt by spending 3 years working on something that I fundamentally didn't like, right? The great maxim of writers is you should write what you know. And I did know about how much I dislike sports. But fundamentally, I'd moved from a position of kind of sports atheism to a kind of queasy agnosticism. Right? I never at no point did I think, oh my goodness, this is amazing. It was 3 years of relative torture. And so I was thinking through, well, okay, you know, you've racked up a bit of a karmic debt. You need to address that. Why don't you write about something you love? I really, really love music and music from the 60s. And I was approached I was approached by the publisher Continuum, who were launching a series of books about individual records, individual albums. And they just came to me and said, is there a particular record that you would like to write about? And I said yes. I would absolutely love to write about the Kinks, and I'd love to write about their record, the Village Green Preservation Society, which is one of my great... I love the Kinks, I love that record. But I also knew immediately, if you were going to write a book of 30,000 to 40,000 words, you couldn't just spend those 30,000 or 40,000 words going, wow, I really like this, it's really good, isn't it? Oh, this is great. You know, and so I felt there were really interesting things to say about how the Kinks fit into the tradition of kind of British pastoralism, in a way, the sense of nostalgia. That is a record of whose songs are about nostalgia, but also, you know, it was made, wow, it's nearly 50 years old. The discussion of it is in itself nostalgic. I thought, and what's been so nice about that book is I still get people writing to me. I mean, that book came out about 13 or 14 years ago. And I still get people writing to me about it. And I know Ray Davis of the Kinks has read it. But I don't know what he thinks about it. I prefer not to know.
It then launched your year of reading dangerously. You say at the beginning of your latest book how 50 great books and 2 not so great ones saved my life. But actually, you were in the habit of lying about books.
That's a bit harsh.
And that this I love this wonderful, wonderful phrase that you used near the beginning. You say that this book is the cast left by the bookworm.
Yes. Okay, so first of all, let's just clarify our terms somewhat. What happened was, as I approached my 40th birthday, I had for several years had the vague notion that I was going to put a list together of great books that I needed to read by the time I was 40, such as The Master and Margarita by Mikhail Bulgakov. Have you read that?
I haven't.
Such
I'm being
as
honest
Middle.
Now.
Yeah, that's good. No one will ever hear this.
And Middle, I've never, yeah. ever read Middlemarch, and I'm quite proud
okay.
of it.
Middlemarch by George Eliot. I never read that. The Communist Manifesto, you ever read that?
Dipped in and out?
Dipped in and out, you haven't read it. Have you read... anyway, it was books like that, Anna Karenina, Pride and Prejudice. Lots of famous, well-known books. Now, I studied English at university, I've been a bookseller, I've been a publisher. I felt it was pretty shameful that there were certain books that I hadn't read. So what I did was I did... this wasn't to write about, this was for my actual life. So I wrote down a list of about a dozen titles, and I looked at them, and as I was looking at them thinking, what do all these books have in common? And I realised that they were all books that I had at one stage or another in my life lied about having read. Now, when I say I lied about them, I wasn't seeking to deceive people. I was a very bookish child, as I said. I love books so much, but my eyes were bigger than my stomach. You know, my appetite for books far outpaced my ability to read them. And when I worked in bookshops, there's also a tendency where you get to be very fluent. I ran a fiction section. If you run a fiction section and you're spending your life looking at the spines of books, you get to know the complete bat list of authors by title, but not actually reading the books. And often a customer will come in and say... they'll pick up. So I remember it used to happen a lot. Joanna Trollope. Now, I've never read a novel by Joanna Trollope because she's not really my, you know, the sort of thing that I would pick up and read. But customers would often come to you and say, this Joanna Trollope, is it good? And after a while, you realise that often they would want you simply to say, yeah, it's great. It's great. You chose a great book. What would happen on the other hand is if a customer came up and said, like a customer came up to me once and said, this book, The English Patient by Michael Ondaatje, is it good? And I told the truth. I said, yes, I've read it. I thought it was awful. At which point another customer intervened and started, and there was a three-way argument at the end of which nobody bought The English Patient. Those two customers never came back into the shop again. You know, there's a certain interesting psychology about what we want as customers from people in bookshops or people in newspapers or people in libraries, you know. So, yeah, so the idea was to go back to the book. I felt that if I actually read those books and was truthful about it, that, you know, I suppose at whatever level I thought, well, that would claw back a bit of integrity, personal integrity. What I actually found... sort of halfway through Anna Karenina, which I think was book 9, what I actually found was that this was the most wonderful and inspiring and energising exercise, reading exercise that I'd probably ever done in my life. And that I had to write about it. I didn't really know what the book would be, but I knew that it was having a transformative effect on how I felt about what I had done with my life up to that point and what I wanted to do with my life going forward.
What the book is to me, as well as this wonderful kind of exploration of these books that very few of which I've read, it's also a kind of memoir, isn't it? And it weaves in and out of your life and tells us so much about you. It also asks a lot of really interesting questions, like what makes a great book?
Yes, what makes a great book? Well, the thing about, yeah, okay. So again, defining our terms. I always try and find what that means. When I say great book to you, what do you think?
I suppose a book that's had Great reviews that's perhaps defined as a classic. I mean, you've got a wonderful quote here. Alan Bennett says, the definition of a classic, a book everyone is assumed to have read and often thinks they have.
Is that great? It's so good. Yeah. One of the things that I found as soon as I started trying to define this was actually great, but the phrase great book can mean almost anything you want it to. You know, if I said to you, Pride and Prejudice is a great book, that would mean it was a famous book. It would mean it was a critically acclaimed book. Mm. If I said to you, Moby Dick is a great book, it wouldn't mean quite the same thing. It would also refer to the size of Moby Dick. If I said to you, One Day by David Nichols, what a great book, that doesn't mean the same thing again. It means something different. Yeah. And so I was quite interested in exploring that. But also from a writer's point of view, I quickly understood that great book could mean whatever you want it to mean. So, for instance, in The Year of Reading Dangerously, I didn't read Ulysses because I had already read it, but I did read War and Peace because it seemed to me that War and Peace fulfills nearly every criteria of greatness: size, critical importance, readability. Have you read War and Peace?
I have, however, read Anna Karenina.
Okay, we're not damning that achievement with faint praise. Anna Karenina is an amazing book, right?
Yeah. Oh, completely.
Extraordinary book.
Yeah.
Extraordinary to sit reading that novel nearly 150 years after it was written and constantly thinking, how can this be 150 years old? Mm. How can the apprehension of human psychology be so spot on? And the thing that Tolstoy does so brilliantly in those books is almost he seems to set himself tasks. I will describe a birth. I will describe arable farming. When people read Anna Karenina, they often get stuck on the farming bits.
Yeah.
I will, whatever he sets out to describe, such is the level of genius we're talking about, and genius is what it is, that he doesn't merely achieve those goals looking back, as it were. We can pick those books up now and they still speak to us. Mm. And in the end, I kind of thought the definition of greatness was, is it alive? Does it speak to me?
Setting yourself this target of these 50 books, and we'll come to the not-so-great ones in a little while, very difficult in terms of just, as you say, the sheer volume of incoming words can be overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder how you do that. Is there a sort of reading regime?
Well, yes. When I started, so I said, didn't I, that book two was Middlemarch. And when I started reading Middlemarch, I really couldn't get on with it. It is quite, you know, I'm not going to fib. It's quite challenging, especially if you're not in the habit of reading 19th century classic literature. So I'd been reading it for a couple of days. I wasn't really getting on with it. And I said to my wife, who had read Middlemarch when she was a student, I said, so I'm not really, I'm finding this is quite hard. Book two is pathetic. And she said, well, you should do what I did. Just read 50 pages a day. And that sounds like such a small thing. But it proved to be the habit that underpinned not just my reading for reading in this year, but actually all my reading since. I've almost developed a kind of OCD need to read 50 pages a day every single day. If I don't, I get angsty. Mm. And a bit like writing, you know, if you say to yourself, I'm going to write 500 words a day, and as long as I do that every day, after a few months, I'll have a book. That's how books get written.
Yeah.
They don't get written only during periods of inspiration in the middle of the night. They get written because you go back to your laptop or your desk every day and just do another 500 words.
Yeah.
And to some extent, that's true with reading some of these books, that one of the things I came to mistrust quickly when I was doing this, and this will sound slightly off-putting and I don't mean it to, is that I came to mistrust whether I was enjoying something or not. You know, if I read Middlemarch, often described as one of the greatest novels ever written by experts, and I don't like Middlemarch, that isn't Middlemarch's fault.
Mm.
It it's not my fault, but it is incumbent on me to try and get to grips with it. And actually, what I found incredibly useful and instructive when working on this book was it's a good way of checking your ego and thinking to yourself, I can't understand everything all the time. I can't get everything straight away. I'm not meant to get everything straight away. Sometimes you just have to have a bit of humility and read your 50 pages and dig in. And it doesn't always work. You can't like everything. Not every book is going to reward you in the same way. In the case of Middlemarch, it very much does. And anybody listening to this, I mean, that book is magical. I mean, it's not magical because it was made by a human being who was a brilliant human being. But its effect, certainly from the halfway point, is extraordinary. It's such a wonderful, wonderful novel. And again, that could be read now, can be picked up, read now, speak to who we are right now.
A couple of books that you compare, and this is one of the not so good ones. You talk about Dan Brown, of course, the author of The Da Vinci Code, but there's a fabulous chapter comparing that to Moby Dick.
Yes, Whale versus Grail. Okay, so the idea of that chapter was, I do a comparative reading of that Moby Dick and the Da Vinci Code. And the purpose of doing that was not to say, oh my goodness, Moby Dick is a masterpiece and the Da Vinci Code is not. It was to try and tease out ways in which books are similar and the reasons people write books are similar. And it was trying to say the reason why Herman Melville wrote his books is the same reason why Dan Brown writes his books, which is to be successful enough to carry on writing books. And in Herman Melville's case, he failed. You know, very famously, Moby Dick was a tremendous flop on publication. The first edition of Moby Dick is 3,000 copies. And it takes 40 years for that first edition to sell out. And that is taking into account a warehouse fire that destroys half the stock. And it's reviewed so badly that Herman Melville has to give up writing novels and go and get a job as a customs officer for the last 20 years of his life. And it's only in the early 20th century, when he's long dead, that Moby Dick starts to be thought of as the work of genius that it is. And one of the reasons for that is it's an incredibly mad, ambitious, crazy book. And it took people decades to begin to understand it. And perhaps we're still struggling to understand it. It's extraordinary. That's not true of The Da Vinci Code, which is great fun. But both those writers are coming from a similar place. I can't lie to you. This book took several years to write. And one of the reasons for that was that chapter took about 4 years to write. Because every 6 months I would think of another thing that I thought, I've got to get that in here.
As I say, the book is also kind of autobiographical. A lot of it told through footnotes. I love the way that at one point you put, if you don't like reading footnotes, piss off. Your mother makes an appearance every now and again.
Don't say that. I sort of say that. Okay, so the thing with the footnotes.
Totally
no,
that.
The footnotes. The thing with the footnotes, I'm going to put this on the record. I've never said this. So the idea with the footnotes in my work, all my books have footnotes in. And the idea with the footnotes, and they are probably, they are influenced by a writer called Nicholson Baker, who wrote a novel called The Mezzanine in the early 1990s. Wonderful book. Very funny. Has very funny footnotes. I really love books where you can detect the author becoming fed up with the book they're writing and with the person they think is reading the book. And so in my work, I often make the footnotes a kind of this awful, wheedly, passive-aggressive voice that bounce off me.
Yeah.
It's like another, the less nice me, right? It's like this nasty little grumbling, homunculus me who pops up at the bottom of the page going, oh, catch up. Oh, you lazy people, right? I find that really funny. So it's partly that. You say my mother?
Your mother is constantly disappointed by you, wants to kind of weep when you're clearly turning into a communist and all the rest. But one thing she does very much like is Alan Titchmarsh. And she loves the...
She loves the work of Alan Titchmarsh.
What really struck me about that is that you and I met at the Emirates Festival of Literature in Dubai. One of the stars of the Emirates Festival was Alan Titchmarsh. Did you meet him?
I met him very briefly. And I should just say, so basically, my mum has said to me several times, why don't I write books that are more like Alan Titchmarsh's? And I've said, well, he's not, we're sort of covering different areas. And I gave her a copy of Brideshead Revisited to read by Evelyn Waugh after we went on a visit to Chatsworth. She read it and she didn't like it very much. And when she handed it back, she said, well, it was all right, but it wasn't as good as Alan Titchmarsh's last novel. So I've been doing this quite a while now, and I've had several books published, and that's good. And I like to think my mum is proud of me. My mum has never, never, this is true, been prouder of me than when I said I'd met Alan Titchmarsh as a fellow author.
Fantastic.
She was genuinely, and he was lovely, right?
He was really nice. Very nice indeed. Being a nice person, well, I suppose the question I'm trying to ask is about having a favourite author, and how is your favourite author necessarily different from your favourite book? And what would be both of those for you?
I'm very drawn to, there's a certain type of author or figure who I really like, and I would describe those as Eeyore-ish. I really love people like Eeyore, Philip Larkin. That sort of grumpy but funny, the comedian Stuart Lee, Morrissey, Jean Rhys, the novelist Jean Rhys, Michelle Welbeck, the French novelist. I love Michelle Welbeck. There's a whole embarrassing chapter in this book about how much I like Michelle Welbeck.
A controversial
figure at best.
Yes.
So partly I like books which I feel capture those personalities, those properties of a kind of funny but grumpy. I think there's a bit of that in my work as well. But probably my favourite book, if I have to pick a book, my favourite book, I'm going to say two. One is Absolute Beginners by Colin McInnes, which is a novel that was written in the 1950s. It was very popular in the 1980s when I was a teenager. It's Little Red Now. Is a wonderful, wonderful book about the race riots in Notting Hill in the late 1950s. There isn't really another British book like it. I mean, we could compare it to The Catcher in the Rye. I think it's a better book than The Catcher in the Rye. Well, that would be a subject for debate. But anyway, I read that when I was 15 years old and it changed my life. And I think the books that you read when you're that age, they tend to, you're wet cement, and they tend to stay with you. And similarly, the book I've probably read more than any other is The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy by Douglas Adams. Again, because it partly because it has that figure, it has Marvin the paranoid android in that grumpy, funny, depressive figure, I find sort of irresistible. But also I love the thing with Adams with the combination of humour and ideas and facility for language and I think you could read those books over and over and over again and you'd never get to the end of them. I think they're wonderful.
Andy, you too, I think, have that Adams-esque quality of facility with language and all the rest of it. I could read your book again and again and again. There is so much to be got out of it. I heartily recommend The Year of Reading Dangerously, How 50 Great Books and 2 Not-So-Great Ones Saved My Life. It's published by Fourth Estate. It's out now. Andy Miller, thank you very much indeed. You've been listening to Meet the Writers. Thanks very much to Antonio Fernandez. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud, or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.